I'm Rick Ganley. This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Last week, NHPR health reporter Todd Bookman tackled the topic no one really wants to talk about, how we hope to live the last days of our lives. In his series, Planning for the End, Todd examines a growing movement in the Granite State to encourage us to have these conversations and to make our end-of-life wishes clear through documents like living wills and healthcare proxies. Still, as Todd reported, this effort has a long way to go.
Only about 1 in 4 adults in New Hampshire have advance directives, and that's on par with national averages. The federal government has tried to boost that number.
My wish is what it's always been. I want to be stuffed in a hefty bag and left out for the garbage men. But they say you're not allowed to do that, so I'll have to make some other plans.
And got a horrible head injury, and he was just catastrophically and irretrievably broken. Poor guy and his poor family were in this horrible situation, which is unfortunately not that uncommon here in New Hampshire. The problem is that he didn't have a legal document that said what he wanted in case of catastrophe, and the truth is that most of us don't.
It is uniquely human to believe that mortality happens to other people. And there is some magical thinking that sort of says if I begin to write my contract around what my mortality might look like, then it would actually happen to me, and that would be terrible. And so I think there's a natural avoidance of issues around death and dying.
Today in The Exchange, we'll explore some of the issues in this series, legal questions, medical concerns, also the emotional side, especially when loved ones have conflicting opinions about what the dying person's wishes really are. Let's hear from you two this hour. Have you dealt with this subject? How did you resolve it? Do you have some kind of an advance directive? If not, why not? What questions or concerns do you have about these documents? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have 4 guests, and Todd Bookman is here, as I said, NHPR's health reporter who just finished this series called Planning for the End. And Todd, thank you very much for your time.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Sean LaFrance, Executive Director of the Foundation for Healthy Communities. And Sean, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Dr. Tim Leahy, Chair of Dartmouth-Hitchcock's Bioethics Committee and an Infectious Disease Specialist. And Dr. Leahy, thanks for making the trip. We appreciate it.
Good morning.
And also with us, Mike Skibbe, Policy Director at the Disabilities Rights Center of New Hampshire. And Mike Skibbe, good to meet you. Thank you also.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and I want to hear from everybody, obviously. But Todd, start with you. What was the big goal for you doing this series? What do you hope listeners really took away from this?
Well, I think at the center of the series is the fact that so many in New Hampshire lack these documents. So many really Americans lack these documents. Generally between 25% and 33% of adults over the age of 18 haven't really thought or at least sort of put in writing what the end of their life should look like. And so there was actually a bill that made its way through committee and then through the two chambers this year that didn't really get a lot of attention, at least in the press, that seeked to make some changes to New Hampshire's advance directive statute to try to streamline it, I think to try to simplify this document and perhaps maybe encourage more people to complete the document. And as I prepared to do a story about sort of just that bill and the changes, I spoke with really a variety of people who are impacted by these advance directives in a lot of different ways. I spoke with doctors, I spoke with patients, families, nursing homes, the courts. And so the goal, I think, of the reporting was to try to give a broad look at advance directives, the strengths of them, and also where they can fall short.
Well, and there's a lot of terminology that we'll go through today, and I believe you put a glossary online. We've got that glossary on our Facebook page and our website. But just now on air, Todd, if we could get some of the most important definitions out of the way.
Well, I think we'll start with advance directives.
So sure.
This is the legal document that allows you to really try to control the decisions about your end of life care should you become unable to make those decisions for yourself. In New Hampshire, this is a two-part document. Part one is where you designate your durable power of attorney for healthcare. So this is the person that you want to make medical decisions for you should you be unable to make those decisions for yourself. you, as the person receiving care, you need to name this person in advance, get this in writing. Most people will choose a spouse or loved one, an adult, a family member, and go over with that person in advance what they would want and get it in writing. The second part of the advance directive is the living will. This is sometimes the term that gets used to lump together what this entire document is. But in New Hampshire, the living will is this second part of the advance directive where you can instruct to your medical providers what sort of care you want. And we think about the term sort of heroic efforts. Do you want heroic efforts used at the end of your life? Do you want sort of the tubes and the breathing machines? Do you want this? Is it appropriate given what you may face? For some people, that's absolutely yes, because it can be the result of an injury, something unexpected. For other people, it's absolutely no. They want complete dignity and complete control, and they want simplicity at the end. So I think those are three sort of broad terms to start. One other, I think, very important point to make is these advance directives, they don't really sort of kick in until you've been deemed to have lost the capacity to make these decisions for yourself. And the capacity question is an interesting one. I think Dr. Leahy could certainly talk about this at length. It's sort of this area where we decide that a person has lost the ability to really understand the risks and the benefits of what they may be facing with certain care. So I think that capacity question is another important thing to understand.
Yeah, and I know Mike Skibbe has some thoughts on that too. And Mike, I want to ask you about that. But first, Sean LaFrance, now you've been working on this issue for a long time at the Foundation for Healthy Communities, trying to get people to sign on to these advance directives that Todd described. And yet, as Todd tells us, a quarter of Americans, a quarter of Granite Staters have these. That means three quarters of us don't. What's the backstory on this issue here in New Hampshire? When did people really start first looking at this?
Well, these laws came into effect in the living will, and that's why so many people associate this with the living will. But then the durable power of attorney statute came in afterwards. We have worked over the years to, in fact, in 2006, we consolidated them into one part of the law, one form of the advance directive. People, I think, as Todd alluded to, I mean, people just don't want to talk about death.
Sure,
and dying.
It's really uncomfortable.
Just, right, it's not a subject matter that people are comfortable with or they want to think about it. I mean, some people think if they talk about it, it might actually happen. So we have worked considerably, particularly in the healthcare sector, to promote this. When these laws first came into effect, oftentimes what we found when we did our early surveys is that the principal people talking about it were lawyers when somebody was doing their will, their estate planning type things. There was very little conversation taking place in the medical world. There was a federal requirement or still is, that came into effect where people have to be offered these if they go into a facility, a hospital or a nursing home. Of course, they are voluntary documents. But we have really put our emphasis on trying to broaden the conversation in a lot of different sectors. And so as the stories last week indicated, somebody like Reverend Dales up in Wolfboro, we've worked with church communities as well as healthcare facilities and really trying to get organizations to have these integral into their programming and not when they actually are in the hospital facing a medical crisis.
Yeah, there's this avoidance factor for sure. We heard about some of that in some of the stories that Todd put out there. Dr. Leahy, to you, how does this three quarters of Granite Staters not having an advance directive, how does this affect your ability to give patients the best care possible?
So this is a real challenge. You know, we have these huge life decisions that we all yammer on about at length. Who are we going to marry? What school are we going to attend? What are we going to have for dinner? But when it comes down to one of the very most important decisions that one could make, what sort of care would you like at a time of catastrophe or near death, we sort of go into denial. And it's sad because it deprives us of the capacity to make those choices. And the thing that's really fairly common is that catastrophe occurs, almost always a surprise, and somebody else ends up making those decisions for us. Say I end up in the hospital with a heart attack and I haven't told anybody what I want, I haven't filled out an advance directive, then the doctors sort of make an educated guess. hopefully there's a family member who I've had a conversation with who could represent for me. But wouldn't it be ideal if there was a document to guide physicians? And that's really what Sean and others' efforts are all about, is the idea of having the patient guide the caregivers at the bedside, even if they can't speak for themselves.
Yeah, and sometimes family members have conflicting opinions about what mom or dad or anyone would do. I wonder also if this, again, three-quarters number, Dr. Leahy, is partly due, in fact, to the fact that some people think only old people need to have these, that young people don't need to worry about it. This is only for when I, you know, pass age 70.
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, not only, you know, do none of us really, you know, feel like talking about death on a sunny August or September day, but I think a lot of us feel like, well, that could never happen to me since I'm 40, 30, 50, whatever. And I think the inescapable truth is that none of us really can predict the future. I don't know with any specificity what will happen tomorrow, and so how detailed could we get? The challenge here is to strike a happy medium, to say, I can't know the future, but I can know some things. And living like that, say, months on a mechanical ventilator would be unacceptable to me, and I want my physicians to know it.
Mike Skibbe, where do you come in to this conversation? Again, Policy Director at the Disabilities Rights Center.
Well, I think that the movement towards increased use of advanced directives is absolutely consistent with the disabilities rights movement, because it's a way of basically enhancing self-determination. And, you know, my office and other advocates have, you know, for years been working towards giving people with disabilities a greater voice in their own lives and ensuring that there's an understanding of the value of self-determination in and of itself.
What about the idea that someone raised earlier, I think it was Todd, this issue of capacity, how you decide who's really capable and who isn't?
Well, I think that one of the concerns that people like me have is sort of a history of underestimating the capacity of people with disabilities. And I think that that's something that's been improving over the last couple of decades, is that people have been able to sort of better recognize, you know, the capability of people with disabilities of all types.
And at some point, we will all have a disability, as I know you and others have said. And we will pick up on that after a super short break. We'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. What's going on this week at NHPR? Well, an easy way for you to find out is when you sign up for our e-newsletter this week at NHPR. You'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week, and also get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine. Everything made from organic and sustainable materials, also on the web at thecleanbedroom.com. And Republic, New Hampshire's original certified local farm-to-table restaurant, breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, Elm Street, Manchester, online at republiccafe.com. New Hampshire weather, mostly sunny for most of the state today. Partly sunny north of the mountains, highs from mid-70s to lower 80s. Clouding up tonight, chance of showers for the North Country, lows in the 50s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at end-of-life planning based on a series by our healthcare reporter, Todd Bookman, last week. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We're looking at some of the legal questions that come up with end-of-life care, medical concerns, and of course the emotional side, especially when families aren't sure what the dying person's wishes really were. Let's hear from you. Have you dealt with this issue yourself? How did you resolve it? Do you have some kind of an advance directive? If not, why not? What comments or concerns do you have about these documents? Again, your comments, questions, concerns are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And just before the break, gentlemen, we were talking about this issue of capacity, and these advanced directives kick in when we are determined to no longer have the capacity to make the decisions ourselves. But as Mike Skibbe started to point out, Dr. Leahy, how do you determine capacity? I mean, there have been evolving definitions of this.
This is a great question. So, You know, this happens pretty frequently in the hospital. Somebody has a head injury and isn't thinking clearly. They've had a stroke. A medicine is making it so that it's hard for them to you know, understand what's going on. They're in a coma. And so while physicians and other caregivers would love to hear the voice of the patient, either the patient can't speak at all, or other times it's kind of a halfway thing. They might be able to tell you, you know, some things, but a complicated decision like what to do at the end of life is beyond them. The challenging thing is that there's no, you know, there's no little red blinking light on top of our heads that indicates that we're fully awake and able to handle these difficult decisions. There's no bright line between having the capacity to do it and not. And so inevitably it ends up being a challenging conversation with the patient, with the family, to say, is this person acting the way they should? And then really testing to see whether they can handle the ifs and the ands and their buts of the situation. Tell me, now that I've explained to you that these are the treatment options, what you think the implications would be of accepting this one or not. And we try to get a feeling for what the patient can or cannot do. As Mike said, there is a history of physician paternalism, where we've kind of denied people their rights to speak for themselves unnecessarily. Now I think there really is, as Mike said, a strong sensitivity to this, so that we really do everything we can to protect our patients' rights.
It's kind of a judgment call, isn't it, on your part?
It is, and so we try to make sure that we sort of see it from all angles. We get nursing input. We get psychiatry input when it's not obvious. We make sure that family members have their say, so that we really have a full reckoning at the end of the conversation.
And what do you think about this issue, Sean LaFrance? Concerns over making a decision over who's truly capable or not?
Yes, it is a judgment call, a clinical judgment call, and so many people are often involved or brought into it to try to assess the process. Ultimately, the determination is made by the physician or nurse practitioner and recorded that way. I think another important dimension of the capacity issue is also the education we have to have with family members sometimes, because they have the conversation, they're designated as the power of attorney, and they may with even good intentions say, well, you know, mother doesn't really understand what she knows. Just talk to me or something like that.
Ignore and what's on the paper?
Well, or ignore the person in the bed who still has some decision-making capacity. They feel like, you know, they've done their advance directive. They were selected as the power of attorney for healthcare. So just let me make the decisions, please. And so they need to be reminded that this is a clinical judgment. It's not just because somebody was selected and put on, their name was placed in a paper. It only becomes active, if you will, once the physician or nurse practitioner determines they lack healthcare decision-making capacity.
Still, that's a heavy decision for a healthcare official to make.
Well, and when the last time the definition changed a little bit, or the process did according to the state in 2007, we spent a good part of a year running some educational programs for physicians looking at the different ways of assessing healthcare decision-making capacity, because as was said, there's not a simple, you know, ask five questions and score it.
Yeah, right. What do you think about that, Mike Skibbe? How well healthcare providers are able to make this decision that, you know, you're not capable and it's time for the advance directive to kick in?
Well, I think that there is a concern in the community about these directives being invoked out of expedience. That's not so much a concern, I don't think, about someone who's in a hospital with an acute injury or illness where there presumably is lots of expertise at hand. I think there's probably more of a concern about them being invoked out of expedience in a nursing home facility, for example, where it's simply easier to use a relative than go through the trouble of communicating with somebody who may be dealing with some sort of disability or just some difficulty communicating. So I think that that's a concern, both in terms of making sure that there's sufficient expertise at hand and that the staff is going through the trouble of communicating with somebody if they have capacity.
Yeah.
One other thing is also for people to recognize that someone may lack healthcare decision-making capacity at a certain point in time and then regain that capacity.
Well, that's the thing,
so
sure.
It's not a one-way street, if you will, in terms of capacity.
Go ahead, Dr. Leahy, and then to our listeners.
So Mike raises a great point that you know, sometimes people are concerned that somehow their rights could be abridged in this process, that they could be thought, you know, sort of deemed not to have capacity when really they do. Or, you know, I'm sure all of us have heard this phrase, death panels. There is a concern amongst the populace that in some way the healthcare system or physicians or others are hoping to deprive patients of their rights. And I think that concern comes from a real risk. And the thing that we have to do as providers and as people trying to get the word out is reassure people that really the goal is to respect patient rights, and that the best way for them to exercise their rights is to be strong advocates for themselves and their families and really get the word out.
All right. Well, I have a lot more questions for all of you, including you, Todd, another question on this issue. But I want to invite our listeners also to join our conversation. The number here in the exchange with your questions or comments about end-of-life planning, advanced directives, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And up first is David in Nashua. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thank you for taking the call.
Go ahead, David.
I was wondering what the thoughts were on advanced directives in the 911 or emergency medical services community with relation to paramedics, firefighters, police departments, first responders. Are they acceptable out in the field or as opposed to a do not resuscitate order?
Yeah, that's a really good question, David. And who wants to jump in on that? You know, a doctor may understand and have a full appreciation for the complexities, like you were talking about, Dr. Leahy, but a paramedic, he or she is trained, Sean, right, to, you know, bring people back to life, do that CPR, use the defibrillator.
Right. David raises a good point about advanced directives. They are guides to care and decision making. But certainly when EMS 911 is called, that the default position is to give people every element of care that they need to keep them well or something. And so the advanced directive is not a document that's used necessarily at the point of, when the ambulance is arriving.
Okay.
We have something, portable do not resuscitate order in effect in our state. That is a medical order, which would guide the paramedics or the EMT personnel in terms of how they might treat somebody in the field, if you will.
So if I'm a paramedic, I arrive on the scene, how do I know, Sean, that you have a DNR? Is there a little bracelet that you have?
It's a pink, bright pink form we have here in the state of New Hampshire. It may be, an 8.5 by 11 version. There's also a card that people may carry, and also the bracelet or a necklace, actually. And it's very prescriptive in terms of saying the person's name, that they are DNR dated, that type of thing.
All right, David, good question. Thank you for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You know, Todd, we talked earlier about how younger people especially think, well, I don't need this. You know, this isn't going to happen to me. The other thing, though, that I think happens is it's hard to say with certainty, I don't want this or I don't want that, when in fact you don't know what kind of medical condition you're going to be in. Even doctors miss it sometimes. People do come out of comas. You had a story in your series about one such person who was even given his last rites and then made a spontaneous recovery, live for another 8 or 9 years. How does that uncertainty, Todd, play into our feelings about signing on to an advanced directive?
Yeah, I think we all would like more of those spontaneous recoveries. They're a tough thing to predict. Your illness or injury is a tough thing to predict. I think there's always going to be uncertainty at end of life. I don't think advanced directives can answer every single question. There is certainly going to be a gray area for a lot of people. That's one reason to continuously update the advanced directive. It is sort of a living document. It is something that can be altered at any time, and in fact should be, as people sort of age or face new diagnosis. In my reporting, I really heard sort of time and again how important the conversations are to have with loved ones, really, as well as with sort of spiritual leaders, with doctors, about what sort of actions to take to really weigh the values in your life that matter to you, and then try to write down a plan that will work. and really explain to your durable power of attorney, the person you've designated, what you'd want. These people, sometimes called the agents, I mean, they are not really supposed to be making these decisions on their own. They're supposed to be carrying out the decisions you've asked them to make for you. And in one of my stories last week, we heard the voice of Ken Braderman, a 64-year-old man with ALS living here in Concord. And he joked at the top of the hour about wanting to be placed in a hefty bag. That was a bit of gallows humor. He had really worked well, though, with his brother, who was going to serve as his agent, with unbelievable clarity about what his wishes were. And I think his brother, as his agent, really appreciated that clarity and knew that when the time came, if these decisions had to be made, what his brother, what Ken would have wanted.
What do you think, Mike Skibbe, this fear that, ooh, once I put it down on paper, I can't change it. Also, maybe I'm afraid to put it down on paper because I don't know what's going to happen to me, especially, you know, people maybe younger than age 60. What do you think?
Well, I think that's understandable. I mean, I was thinking as Todd was talking about how there's sort of a fundamental assumption that this whole idea of advanced directives is based on, which is that we can predict what we will want at a time that is completely, you know, it's an experience that none of us will have more than once.
Right. So how do you even make those decisions?
And I think that there are, I mean, there's certainly commentary that suggests that people actually have wishes often that are very different at that time than they imagine they will be. But I think that the best that we have is allowing the individual to try to predict what they will want at that time. So I don't think that that's an argument against using advanced directives. But I think that we have to be modest about this and understand that, you know, this is something that probably needs to be revisited throughout our lifetime as we mature, gain more insight, see other people going through similar experiences.
Okay. Let's take some more calls, all of you. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email us if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And up next is Peggy in Hollis. Hi, Peggy. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning. Just as in disclosure, I am Senator Peggy Gilmore, the sponsor of Senate Bill 170. And first of all, I want to thank Todd for the great and educative series that he did, and to you for doing this on air today, because as we know, the most important thing is to bring people to the place of education where they will have the conversation. They'll start the conversation around the kitchen table, as it were, so that families and caregivers and spiritual leaders all know what we want. But I want to talk a little bit about sometimes, unfortunately, politics gets involved. And I think when we let that happen, we do a great disservice. This is not in any way a partisan issue. You know, this is something that applies to everybody, regardless of your political stripe. And in sponsoring Senate Bill 170, the one that simplified the current advanced directive law, there was some pushback. There was an attempt to table the bill. And I think that's due to, you know, sometimes misunderstanding, not full understanding of what our church leaders have kind of guided us through and what our political leaders are saying. And that's just a real danger that we all have to avoid.
So you see this issue being politicized, Senator Gilmore?
I think that it can be politicized. And when that happens, I think we do a disservice to each and every one of us who has, I think, the greatest gift that we can give our families, as Dr. Leahy has said, is trying to spare them the anguish of making decisions when we're trying to make those decisions, you know, in a vacuum or without the comfort of knowing that we've had the conversation that we all need to have. I mean, this is what we need to do as members of you know, our family and our social circle. We need to talk to our loved ones.
Well, Senator Gilmore, thank you for calling in. And Todd, you mentioned this in your series, the so-called death panels that got brought up in the 08 election, I believe it was. And then the Terri Schiavo case, the young woman in Florida who had a massive heart attack and had serious brain damage. Her husband wanted to take her off life support. Her parents did not. Talk a little bit about that politicization of this issue.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessarily going to go away. We saw it to some extent in this process. I think historically the Catholic Church has had some major concerns, not necessarily about advance directives, but about medically administered nutrition and hydration. And this was at the sort of core of Senate Bill 170 that Senator Peggy Gilmore sponsored. This was changing medically administered nutrition and hydration at the end of life, the classification to a life-sustaining treatment. So the default could have been, that we go to these measures to sort of keep people alive when there's no sort of other plan in place. And I think Dr. Leahy can talk about sort of the pros and cons of this approach. I mean, these medical advancements can keep us alive, and there's certainly a point where that is the right choice. If a cure is possible, if full recovery is possible, I think everybody would sort of jump at that opportunity. Well, let's go for it. But there are also people that say, you know, there's a time in life where maybe this fight is going to strip me of some of my dignity. This is a fight that I can't win. And so I think there is going to always be sort of some contention about which direction to go, especially with that topic.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that, Dr. Leahy. It gets to what Mike Skibbe said earlier, too, that you need to keep revisiting these advance directives in light of changing medical practices, advances, and so forth. Go ahead, Dr. Leahy. I'm interested in what you have to say on this.
So, you know, Todd raises a great point, which is that there are so many different technologies that providers can bring to bear to try to save a life or to promote dignity and every place in between. And really, patients and their families can't be expected to know all the nuances of every one of these treatments. And I think that is sometimes an obstacle to having these conversations. They sort of think, how could I know enough? I think the really important thing is to take a step back and just say, you know, I'm going to be in conversation with the physicians. They can provide advice about the details of the medical treatment. But what the family and most importantly, the patient need to indicate is, you know, sort of what box are they in? Do they want everything done no matter what? Do they want only measures that are directed at dignity? Or do they want some middle-of-the-road approach?
Well, and dignity is a subjective term, too.
Absolutely. And then I think then the negotiation can begin where a physician would say, well, so in your case, my advice to you might be that you not have a surgery, but you have this less invasive approach, and the conversation continues. And in the end, I think the patients get more of what they want.
But at least, even with all that complicated medical stuff, if you have the advance directive, it helps. It helps you boil it down. Sounds like that's what you're saying.
Amen.
All right. We will take more calls after a short break, so stay on the line. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a back-to-school discussion with Education Secretary Arne Duncan. Then, a leading psychiatrist on facing adversity in his own life. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from North Branch Construction, celebrating 55 years in business. From custom-built homes to eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And from New England College School of Graduate and Professional Studies, now in the heart of Concord, offering a master's in public policy. Information at nec.edu. Mostly sunny for most of the state today, partly sunny north of the mountains. Highs today from mid-70s to lower 80s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at advanced directives for end-of-life care. Some of the issues that came up in a recent series by NHPR health reporter Todd Bookman called Planning for the End. We're looking at some of the medical concerns, the emotional side of this issue, also some of the legal questions that come up. And we want your comments and thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Sue's been waiting in Concord. Hi, Sue. Thanks for hanging on. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Hello.
Go ahead, Sue.
We've all heard stories about physicians or squabbling family members who don't hold with advance directives and they won't follow them. What guarantee does a person have that they will be followed by a physician in a hospital setting or a hospice setting? Or how do you handle family members that just can't agree?
Oh, Sue, I'm so glad you called. And Dr. Leahy, every time we talk about this topic, we get a call from at least one person who says, my husband or wife had this wish, and then, you know, different family members got involved. His or her wishes were not carried out, and they're heartbroken.
Yeah, this is, you know, challenging family communications are, difficult in every environment, but no more so than at the end of life and in the hospital when difficult decisions need to happen. And I think one thing many providers will tell you about is that at the bedside when somebody is conflicted in their relationship or if you know, just sort of communications have been difficult over the years, that can sort of be intensified and brought out and sort of complicate that decision-making process even more than it already is. There's no easy answer to this, but one thing that can really help is for the patient to have identified the person whom they really want to speak for them first, so that in the event that there is not only a little bit of disagreement, but disagreement that can't be negotiated through, that at the end it's clear who speaks for the patient. Now, this is only in the case when the patient can't speak for themselves. If they can speak for themselves, then, you know, obviously they have the final say.
And Todd, this gets into something that is being considered, I think, for next year's legislature, default surrogacy. How does that play into this question that Sue has and what Dr. Leahy says?
I think a lot of people are sometimes surprised to learn at the bedside sometimes that they, as a spouse or maybe as an adult child of a parent who's facing the end of life, that they don't automatically get this decision-making power. And so when there is some conflict that arises, that isn't granted. New Hampshire is one of only, I believe, six states in the nation that doesn't have this idea of a default surrogacy, so that there's some sort of structure laid out in law that says if capacity has been lost, a spouse automatically gets that decision-making power, or an adult child gets that decision-making power. There are certainly flaws in a default surrogacy statute, and I think there's been a good team assembled around the state to look at this issue and figure out a way that New Hampshire could bring about some sort of clarity in law for this issue. And so I think that's something we may see moving ahead. But New Hampshire at this point does not have that sort of provision, which means that sometimes these cases end up in a courtroom.
So default surrogacy, Todd, would mean I haven't directed anybody, so people just automatically assume it's my husband.
Correct. They made and in some states that may be the case. In some states that doesn't mean your husband will get to make every decision on your behalf. There's sort of a gradient in the law, and I think New Hampshire is trying to chart a course right now to figure out a system that will work best for us that preserves patients' rights.
Mike Skibbe, what are some of the issues that come up in this suggestion of default surrogacy? I mean, you're kind of prejudging family situations here, so I just wonder what you think.
Well, I think that it's something that really needs to be grappled with, because if you think about it, the majority of people are going into the end of their lives without having spoken about what their wishes are. And the hospitals presumably are trying to do the best that they can. So it's important to have this debate. It's a particularly sensitive area for people with disabilities, because this is an area where they actually haven't spoken, though. And so it's not really necessarily a way to sort of enhance self-determination. It's more of a practical problem. So I think that there's a lot of sensitivity to this in the community. Probably one of the most important debates is going to be about the scope of such a statute. In other words, are we just talking about who's going to make the decision when somebody has been in a car accident and what's going to happen while they're unconscious? Or are we talking about what's going to happen to somebody during months of care in a rehabilitation facility or a nursing home? At some point, people like me believe that you need to go into a more formal process, perhaps guardianship, but that it's obviously that you can't do that in every case of an acute illness or injury.
So do you think default surrogacy is a good idea or not?
I think that it's something that is currently unregulated and ought to be regulated. I think that there's some easy areas of this, and some very complex and difficult ones, some of which are revolving around this issue of the extent of their use.
Dr. Leahy, real quick, and then back to our listeners.
So I wrote recently in the Scientific American blogs in a piece called Voiceless at the End of Life about a family that was grappling with exactly this issue, where they all agreed, a brother and sister were the main representatives for a comatose patient, that he really shouldn't be given intensive care in this way. He never would have wanted to live like this, they said. And yet, because there was no default surrogacy law, they didn't have the legal right to represent and do what they felt was right for him. So in some cases like this, the need for the law is really acute, and it's just heartbreaking to see the family have to go to court more than once to be able to get this right. The hope is that at least we'll be able to fix that problem. Mike raises the more complicated issue of chronic care and what if there are family member disagreements. And I think you're right, oversight of that process and making sure we don't make mistakes by trying to do the right thing is a good idea.
And again, if you have an advance directive, if you've designated someone as your healthcare proxy or durable power of attorney that's on the France, then you avoid this problem.
Exactly. So right. That's why we believe that these conversations and trying to promote this ahead of time could avoid these difficult situations we're describing right now.
Let's take another call if we could. This is David in Greenfield. Hi, David. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hello. Yes, thank you. My question is on advance directives and living wills in particular. If you don't want extreme measures to be taken, such as a feeding tube, shouldn't you at least have hydration? Isn't a feeding tube and hydration two different things?
Wow, and this is a good point and something that came up in the series. I know Todd and Dr. Leahy, go ahead, because as Todd mentioned, medical standards are evolving, medical treatments are evolving, medical advances are always coming down the line.
This is a great example of that which box are you in question. The idea is to first consider, what are our goals? Are we trying to prolong life? Are we trying to go for a cure? Is it something different? Then, once we've decided that, we decide what the intervention is. Sometimes family members and patients will have the misunderstanding that a patient will suffer if not given hydration or nutrition when the goals are not cure. You know, they'll say, we know that the patient is going to die of his lung cancer. We really want him just comfortable and to have dignity. But shouldn't we give IV fluids or shouldn't we give, food by vein? In actuality, those interventions are really more about sustaining life. And patients can be very comfortable and have great dignity without having intravenous fluids, the inconvenience of a line, and all the hassle. And that's something that, in conversation with their providers, patients can really come to the right decision.
Because it sounds cruel, taking that away.
It does, because I imagine what it would be like for me to miss one or two meals, and so I extrapolate from that. It turns out that if somebody's at the end of life and being kept comfortable, that having or not having intravenous fluids is really not part of comfort.
All right. Thanks a lot for the question, David. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. I also want to get your thoughts, Sean LaFrance, on what keeps coming up, this idea of you can revisit these things as medical advances change, as our understanding of the dying process changes. And I'd love to get your thoughts in there, too.
Well, in addition to the changes in medicine, the important thing is that our changes in our relationships, so that you may decide at a certain age, you do your advanced care plan, and that's important. And I think the critical thing is selecting the person that you trust to make those decisions, who can represent your interest. And that's the critical piece, I feel like, in this whole process when we talk about relationships and conversations for advanced directives. But we also know those situations change because, relationships do.
You might have a falling out with someone.
Exactly. Or... somebody just may, you may be close to your siblings and the one you've selected, and then they move out west and you're still in the east. And so your other sibling might be the better person. So I think it is really important that, as Mike said, it's a living document. It's something to be revisited.
How hard is it to make those changes? Do you have to go down to your lawyer's office, or can you just white it out, or, how do you do that?
You don't have to go to the lawyer's office to do something like this. We have an advanced care planning guide online available for free. People can download that and change it. I think the important thing is, when changes are made, that copies are provided to the person that you've selected to make those decisions for you, and also to your healthcare provider, a primary care doctor, or if you live in a community where you go to the same hospital all the time, if you have to go to the hospital, you might put it there. Nowadays, most of these are recorded in the electronic health records in some way, so that the information is available to the caregivers or health providers when you're there. but they definitely are something to be reviewed periodically.
Okay. Let's take one more call if we could. And this is Katrine in Franconia. Hi, Katrine. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura and panel. Just to comment on how important the advance directives are, my stepfather had heart surgery, and they had to suspend the advance directives for the heart surgery. And then, you know, his situation worsened and some other, you know, I'm not going to get into all the details, but ultimately they, you know, it seemed like he was failing, and I was on his advance directives as an agent and had never had a conversation with him about what he really wanted. But because it was spelled out in the directives that were written 2 years ago, and my mom was not, you know, she was the first agent, but was very, you know, that was a very difficult thing for her. So it was really great that he had chosen me, even though we didn't have a conversation. It would have been easier to have had a conversation. But even without the conversation, it was helpful to say, you know, this is what he said 2 years ago when he was in his right mind. And now he's not in his right mind, and he's clearly failing. So let's not prolong this.
So he designated two of you, Katrine.
He actually designated three. He designated my mom first, one of his daughters second, and then I'm his stepdaughter, and he designated me third. And he did send me a copy, so I knew that I was on there. But, you know, we just didn't have the conversation of, geez, this is what I would think or what I would like. And
it was challenging. You had it on paper. Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Because of heart surgery, you know, he was trying to take his best shot to live, to not die of congestive heart failure. So he clearly wanted to live. But under the circumstances, it wasn't going very well. And so something had to be done differently, or things might have been prolonged because he was on a feeding tube.
Katrine, this is real interesting. Mike Skibbe, have you heard of instances? We've talked so much this hour about designating one person where a couple people are designated. Is that typical?
I've heard of it. I've heard that it's also discouraged because you don't want to encourage conflict.
What do you think about Katrine's story?
Well, I think that she's right, that it was an opportunity for her stepfather to really have a say in his care, even though they didn't have that explicit conversation.
Yeah. What do you think, Sean? Three people,
but I'm not sure in Katrine's example, but most the way you want people to designate alternates, so that because if they select their spouse, for instance, and this is a difficult circumstance, and that person just feels overwhelmed, for instance, then you want to know that there's somebody else in their family situation. It sounded like the man's daughter, and then so that's actually a good process, and that's encouraged actually in the forms that we provide people to select those alternates.
Yeah, Dr. Leahy.
Katrine raised a really important point, which is that her father-in-law or stepfather wanted to have a go at life. He was willing to go through a surgery, but what he really needed most from his family, and which he was lucky to have, was the ability to say, okay, you know what, I tried and it didn't work out. This is a big issue in our hospitals nowadays, is that oftentimes people will say, yeah, go for it, do the surgery, do the procedure. But then there's nobody to step in and say, you know what, it's been a few days, it's been a week, and now we can tell it's not going to go right, and it's time to change course and move more toward comfort and dignity. So Katrine, I think you and your other family members did a great service.
Yeah, Katrine, thanks for the call. And I want to end with an email from Michelle in Bow, who says, I lost my dad somewhat unexpectedly a week ago. One of the main things that helped our family get through the past week was that my father had talked with us about his death, clearly outlined his desires. I repeatedly said to family and friends what a gift and a comfort that was. He had planned for at least some of the details to get us through those difficult first days after his passing. He always said, death is just a fact of life. So Michelle says, for anyone that does not have a living will or a written plan for those final days, I would encourage them to think of it as just like that, a final gift for your loved ones. It certainly was for us. Todd, I'm guessing you heard that again and again and again when you did this reporting. Thanks, Michelle, for the email.
I did, from both doctors and from family members, how important these conversations are, how important they are to have very early, to not wait till these decisions need to be made at the bedside, to give this gift, as people call it, to your family in advance, so that there can be clarity, real clarity, when the time comes.
Well, so given the value of it, and Michelle, you spoke about it so beautifully, Todd, you did report only 25% of Granite Staters have advanced directives. Only 25% of Americans have these. So what gives? Where's the disconnect? Everybody's saying it's so great, it's such a gift, and yet on the other end, nobody's doing it.
Well, I think it's important to point out that as people age, they are more likely to fill out these documents. We see in nursing homes, the percent is actually about 65%. So people, I think, once they're told about the importance of these directives, and death seems almost more tangible as we get older, I think we see more people taking the time to complete these documents. The challenge is still convincing 20-somethings, 30-somethings, that it's worth sitting down with a loved one and figuring out what the plan might be if an accident arises. So yeah. I think there's still some ways to go, at least for the younger generations.
That's your job, Sean LaFrance.
Right. And so we're trying to encourage people to talk to their family and friends and pick that person that they trust who could make those decisions.
All right. Well, all of you, tough topic. Thank you very much for coming in. Sean, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Sean LaFrance, Executive Director of the Foundation for Healthy Communities. Mike Skibbe, good to have you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mike Skibbe, Policy Director at the Disabilities Rights Center of New Hampshire. And Dr. Tim Leahy, thank you also for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Dr. Tim Leahy is Chair of Dartmouth-Hitchcock's Bioethics Committee and an Infectious Disease Specialist. And Todd Bookman, congratulations on the series and thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Todd Bookman, NHPR's health reporter. Again, if you want to take another look at Todd's series, you can go to our Facebook page or on our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, examining elder abuse. It's often a hidden problem, the aged living alone or isolated from the community, where they fall prey to mistreatment by caregivers or family members. The abuse can be physical, emotional, or involve financial exploitation. Now, senior advocates are pushing to raise awareness about these problems and emphasize the responsibility to report them. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange, tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR 958. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Dos Amigos Burritos, fresh Mexican eat-in or takeout, Hearty, Healthy, Happy in downtown Portsmouth, Dover, Concord, and Manchester. Online menu at dosamigos.com. And from RM Davis Incorporated, celebrating 35 years of providing investment counsel, wealth management, and trust services with offices in Portland and Portsmouth. Online at rmdavis.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. The annual back-to-school ritual takes place this year amid big changes. This fall, a total of 28 states and the District of Columbia will fully implement Common Core Standards, a set of state-designed guidelines that describe what students need to know before they advance.